Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vayishlach. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Vayishlach. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parshat Vayishlach. Ostensibly, our parsha creates a closure of events which began at the end of Parshat Toldot. To refresh our memory, Jacob masqueraded as his brother, and on that basis received a blessing from his father. Esav is very angry at Jacob. He is wounded. He is pained. He plots to kill Jacob. Rivka discovers his intent and does everything to get Jacob out of the house. She convinces Yitzchak that Jacob needs to go to Rivka's homeland to find a wife, that her life would be totally intolerable if Jacob were to marry Canaanite women. In last week's parsha, the parsha begins with Jacob embarking on his journey. And as he's about to leave the land of Israel, he falls asleep and has a dream where God tells him, "Do not be afraid, Jacob. I will be with you. I will see to it that you will come back." And Jacob calls the place of his dream Beit El, the house of God. And Jacob takes an oath. And the oath is that if in fact God will take care of him and he will come back in peace, he says that I will, this is chapter 28, verse 22. He says, "The stone which I have placed as a matseva, as a monument, will become a house of God. And all that God will give me, from all that God will give me, I will tithe to him." So now let's look at our parsha. Jacob was sent by his father and his mother to find a wife. Jacob, in fact, gets married to four wives, Rachel, Leah, Bilhah, Zilpah. Not only does he have four wives, Jacob has 11 children. Excuse me, I should correct that. He has 12 children, 11 boys, one girl, Dinah, so that one could say, mission accomplished. Jacob ran away because his brother hated him, because his brother wanted to kill him. And in the beginning of our parsha, as Jacob is about to enter the land of Israel, this is actually before he comes, because in fact this is occurring on the eastern side of the Jordan River, Jacob decides to send to his brother to do what we might call a preemptive strike, to bring about a reconciliation with his brother. And as I mentioned in the beginning, to create closure so that his brother will no longer hate him. And in a previous podcast, I have discussed at length this initial chapter of our parsha, how Jacob repeats again and again, he is the servant, Esav is the master, how Jacob offers him compensation for the blessing which he has taken. But perhaps even more significantly, how Jacob says to Esav at one point, and the words are very, very telling. This is chapter 33, verse 11. Kachna et birchati asher huvat lach. Take my blessing, which has been given to you. He is not just giving Esav some tribute, as a servant would give to a master, but he is giving him the blessing back on a silver platter. Take the blessing. If the essence of the blessing is that I am the master and you are the servant, I am calling you the master. I am the servant. If the essence of the blessing has to do with my material well-being, here, take this, one could say, token expression of my material success, so that in no way should you be compromised. Jacob is trying to create a certain closure. Interestingly enough, in chapter 33, when Jacob sees Jacob, we're told how he runs to him, how he kisses him, how he hugs him. They cry. Throughout, Esav refers to him as my brother.
And at the end, Esav says to him, "Come with me." He invites him to come to live with him. And Jacob, I would say, invents a very lame excuse that, "I can't really go with you. I have a lot of children. They'll hold you up." And then Esav says, "Well, maybe I'll just leave some men with you, okay?" And Jacob says, "No, don't do me any favors. Let me go at my own pace, and I'll get to you." And at the end of this encounter, we're told in chapter 33, verse 16, "On that day, Esav returned to his path to go to Seir." Seir, which is in the area of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, southern Jordan. And Yaakov went on his path to Sukkot. To phrase it differently, they part ways. In another podcast, I have discussed how this was perhaps a missed opportunity. There could have been a real reconciliation between Yaakov and Esav. And instead, there was an attempt at reconciliation, an attempt at closure. But it was the type of closure which basically expressed itself in, "You go your way, I go my way." Interestingly, when we go back to last week's parsha, we would have expected that in the aftermath of this encounter between Yaakov and Esav, that the next thing which Yaakov would do would be to go to Beit El. And let's just understand why. Here is Yaakov, who was a fugitive, who was running away from his brother who hated him. Here is Yaakov, who was going to a place which was very terrifying, a place which we see was actually not very, very warm and open and inviting. And despite all that, he returns with great wealth, with a large family. He has been able to deflect the threat of Esav, and so that this would be the appropriate moment for Yaakov to go to Beit El, for Yaakov to now fulfill the vow which he had made at the beginning of last week's parsha, that if in fact he will return to his home in peace, that he will now take that stone which he had placed there and make it into a house of God. He will now offer God his tithes. And instead, what happens? We are told in chapter 33, verse 17, that Yaakov does not go to Beit El. Yaakov goes to a place, Sukkot. Although we don't know the exact location of Sukkot, many scholars assume that Sukkot is located on the eastern side of the Jordan. Perhaps I should have not part of the promised land. And what does he do there? He builds to him a house. And to his cattle he builds booths. And therefore they call the name Sukkot, booths. A very, very strange type of situation. First of all, it's very strange that Yaakov should name the place for the booths which he had made for his cattle. Note the fact that Yaakov builds a house, but the house is for him. It is not a house of God. It is not in Beit El. For whatever reason, Yaakov is delaying the fulfillment of his vow. There are commentaries who want to argue that Yaakov did not want to immediately go back to Beit El, to his father, because Yaakov still needed to somehow, using our language, process his encounter with Esav. That Yaakov perhaps still needed to solidify his safety, and that maybe building this house was meant to be a safeguard against Esav, to maybe allow some more time to pass for Esav's anger and enmity to assuage. According to the rabbinic understanding, or a rabbinic understanding, Yaakov spent 18 months in this place. And then in chapter 33, verse 18, we're told, "Vayavo Yaakov shalem ir Shechem, vayichan et pnei ha'ir." The Yaakov comes, and here I'll take one translation, whole, complete, to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. It is very interesting that Yaakov makes a stop in the city of Shechem. This actually takes us back to the story of Avraham in chapter 12 of Bereishit. When God said to Avraham, "Lech lecha, leave your father's house, Haran, come to the land of Israel." The first place where God appears to him is in the city of Shechem. And it's in that place that God says to him, "To your seed, I will give this land." Here is Yaakov, who is retracing the steps of his father, of his grandfather, excuse me, although one might say his spiritual father, who is Avraham. The Torah says that Yaakov comes to Shechem whole, intact. And given what I mentioned earlier, perhaps we could say that yes, now is the point of closure. Yaakov has his family. Yaakov, perhaps at this point, no longer has to fear Esav. And Yaakov, in Shechem, purchases a plot of land. Perhaps this is the actualization of what God had said to Abraham, to your seed I will give this land. He is now being proactive. He is beginning to take possession of a plot of land. There is a rabbinic comment which says, when it says at the end of verse 18, he encamps the face of the city, that he actually began to engage in all types of activities that could benefit the city. And the last thing which we're told is that he builds an altar, and he calls the altar God, the God of Israel. On the one hand, we could say, what Jacob is doing is extremely positive, purchasing land in Israel. One might say not only land to be buried in, but land to live in. He is trying to not only establish a foothold in the land of Israel, but establish cordial relationships with the locals. And perhaps most important in terms of his mission, he builds an altar, and he names the altar God, the God of Israel. The God of Israel is an acknowledgement of the new name which he has been given, which is Israel. And one might say of the new destiny which he has, that he now is in the process of becoming the people of Israel. So that he is not building an altar as an individual who is bringing the awareness of God to the people around him, but perhaps he is building an altar which is now establishing the presence of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, establishing the worship of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. But there is a bit of a problem. Given what we've seen, perhaps this should have been done in Beit El. And in fact, the story which follows, chapter 34, which we have also discussed in a previous podcast, is the beginning of cracks which are forming in the house of Jacob. Essentially, the story has to do with the rape of Dinah, who is being held captive, of negotiations which go on for her release, although ostensibly it's for her marriage to the person who raped her, Shechem. And to make a long story short, eventually, Shimon and Levi, two of Yaakov's sons, destroy the whole city, loot it, kill all the men who were unable to protect themselves, who were vulnerable because they had just performed Brit Milah, circumcision, as a gesture of becoming one people with the family of Jacob. I mentioned earlier, in this story, there begin to be cracks in the house of Jacob. Note the fact that in previous stories, Abraham was very concerned about his wife being taken by the people around him, very concerned that they would take him and kill him. And in one story, when Abraham is in the land of Egypt, Pharaoh takes his wife, but nothing happens other than great plagues being brought on the house of Pharaoh. This is in chapter 12. And eventually, Sarah is given back to Abraham, along with many gifts that were given to him as well. In another story, chapter 20, Sarah is once again taken by Avimelech. And this time, God appears to Avimelech in a dream and warns him, do not come near to this woman. Nothing happens. Not only does nothing happen, she is given back to Avraham. She's also given money, what could be called eye-covering money. This is the first story where God does not intervene, where God allows, so to speak, Shechem to rape Dinah, where in the end, they do come out with a lot of money from the story, but as a result of looting. In the words of Shimon and Levi, their sister has been defiled. Such a thing should not be done to the house of Jacob. Jacob's home, which is complete, which is Shalem, where everyone ostensibly is now part of the larger mission of Israel, is now beginning to unravel. The daughter of Jacob is raped. The sons of Jacob kill and loot. Although in our parsha, Jacob is not happy with what his sons did, and his discomfort is expressed in terms of geopolitical considerations, that what you have done will bring upon us a retaliation which in the end could completely destroy us. But at the end of the book of Bereshit, just before Jacob dies, when he blesses his sons, Shimon and Levi are questionably blessed. Jacob says, "Your anger is cursed because it is tenacious." Cursing their anger perhaps echoes something which we see by Noah, when somehow his nakedness is revealed, and he curses his younger son when he says, "Arur Knaan, Cain should be cursed. A servant of servants he shall be to his brothers." Jacob does not say that. But nevertheless, the fact that they are not blessed, and there's an element of curse, as I said, creates the sense of breach in the house of Jacob. Interestingly, in the aftermath of this story, in chapter 35, verse 1, "And God said to Jacob, 'Get up, go up to Beit El, settle there, make there an altar to the God that appeared to you when you ran away from Esav, your brother.'" God says, "Kum, get up." And I think we can see in many other places in the Tanakh, whenever God says to somebody, "Get up," that implies that the person is procrastinating. That implies that they're delaying in doing something which they need to be doing. God says that in the book of Jonah, when Jonah tries to run away and not carry out his mission to go to the people of Nineveh. And this perhaps may be showing how Jacob was wrong in not going immediately to Beit El, to create a closure, to build an altar, to somehow pay his acknowledgement to the God who had saved him and been with him the whole time. Not only that, but God even says to him, "Shev Sham," where the word "shave" doesn't just mean sit, settle there. That's where you need to be. It seems that Jacob wanted to settle down perhaps in Shechem, and God needs to remove him from there and tells him the place you need to be is Beit El. And what is Yaakov's response? In verse 2, he says to his house, and note again, the house is a central motif here, "and to all that are with him, remove the foreign gods that are in your midst. Purify yourself. Change your clothing." On the one hand, if we take this literally, I mentioned that Shimon Levi had looted Shechem. And it's conceivable that in taking the possessions of Shechem, that they had taken all types of graven images, foreign gods, silver and gold. And what he's saying is, you must remove them. He's also saying, purify yourself. From what? Perhaps purify yourself from the bloodshed that you did there. Purify yourself from the looting. Purify yourself. You said that the rape of Dina created impurity in the house of Jacob. Perhaps now we need to purify ourselves sexually. And when he says, change your clothes, we can also understand that in a slightly different way as change your persona. The clothes that make the man, the clothes that are a statement of your role. Somehow the clothes that were worn in Shechem, Jacob feels, should not be the clothes of who the Jewish people need to be. They need to take on a different identity. And perhaps that will all be connected with the altar which will be built in Shechem. Interestingly, in chapter 35, verse 5, they travel and we're told that the fear of God, one could translate it perhaps better, chitat, as the dread, the terror of God, is on this all the cities which are around about, so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. From that verse, we can see that Jacob's fear that there would be a retaliation against his family was quite founded. And it's only because the terror of God is upon them that they're able to leave in peace. And perhaps we could add, that only happens when they pick up and go. When they do what they need to do, which is to go to Beit El. And as I said before, create a closure. And we're told in chapter 35, verse 7, they come to this place, Jacob builds an altar. He calls the place El Beit El, because there God revealed himself when he ran away from his brother. And ostensibly at that moment, closure has been created. And perhaps we could say, a certain chapter in Jacob's life has now come to an end. Jacob has now come back and is ready to move forward in the land of Israel, the chapter of his being a refugee, a fugitive, has finally come to an end. Perhaps there is one more element here which I think is important, and that is the next verse, verse 8. It says that Dvorah, the nurse or nanny of Rivka, died, and she is buried below Beit El, below the oak tree. And he called the place the oak bachut, of crying. There is a rabbinic comment which addresses the question, why all of a sudden are we told about this? And why do we care about the nanny of Rivka? And the rabbis say that the death of her nanny underscores Rivka's own death. Yes, her nanny died, but according to the rabbinic understanding, whether just before or immediately afterwards, Rivka herself dies. And when Jacob calls this the oak of crying, it is not only the oak where they're weeping the death of Dvorah, it is the oak where he weeps the death of his mother. And perhaps this is the final element of closure. Rivka, who is the driving force behind Jacob's masquerade, behind his getting the blessing, and as a result of that, who then pushed him to run away. And the Rivka, who is very concerned that if he doesn't run away, she will be bereaved of him, ironically loses Jacob by her act. According to the rabbinic understanding, from the moment Jacob runs away, he never sees his mother again. So that this creates the final closure to the story. One could say, in fact, a very tragic closure. One might even add, parenthetically, that she said, "Why should I lose both of you?" Anticipating that if Esav kills Yaakov, that will break her relationship with Esav as well. But it would seem to be that that relationship is already broken, and that she does not have a relationship with Esav either in the aftermath of what happened. So this pasuk perhaps becomes the closure of those events which happened in the end of Parshat Toldot. The taking of the blessing, Jacob's running away, his accomplishments while being outside the land of Israel, and now he finally comes back to the land of Israel, and he is at the cusp of starting a new chapter. Hence, what you find in chapter 35, verse 9, is that it says, "And God appears to Jacob further in his coming back from Paddan Aram." And here I would like to interpret it, not only did God appear to Jacob and tell him, when he was in Shechem, "Get up, go to Beit El," but God is now appearing to him a next time. What happens this time? God blesses him. God says to him, "Your name is no longer Jacob, your name is Israel." God says to him, "Be fruitful, multiply. A nation and a multitude of nations shall come from you. Kings will emerge from your loins. And this land which I have given to Abraham and Isaac, to you I will give it, and to your children afterwards." Which means God is now appearing to Jacob a second time. The first time was in Shechem, when God said to him, "You need to create closure. You need to round out that chapter of where you were a fugitive on the run, where you had to go to Laban's house." I might even say, where you had to, in effect, lay the foundations of the next chapter in your life. You had to build a home, build a family. You had to somehow make amends with Esav. And now you are able, you had to come back to Beit El, build an altar, make a house of God, and perhaps you had to experience the loss of your mother. And now you're able to finally begin the establishment of the Jewish people. You now have a new name, Israel, because your children will be known as the children of Israel. You now have the land before you for you to take. You now have the blessing of being fruitful and multiply to ultimately establish yourself as a nation. An obvious question is that Jacob has already been fruitful and multiplying. So what does it mean to say, "Goyu kahal goyim," will come from you? And Rashi, quoting a rabbinic comment, says that in fact, you still have something, a nation to be formed, Benjamin. And you also have a congregation of nations, the children of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, in the aftermath of this new directive, this new mission, Jacob builds the altar, And Jacob once again calls the place Beit El, but it takes on a new meaning. And Jacob now decides to leave Beit El. And as he leaves Beit El, we are told in the next story of the birth of Benjamin on the one hand. Benjamin, who completes the family of Jacob. Benjamin, who was the last of the 12 tribes. Benjamin, the only one born in the land of Israel. And yet this is a bittersweet moment, because at the birth of Benjamin, Jacob's beloved wife, Rachel, dies. So that Jacob now, starting off, on the one hand, reaches completion with the birth of Benjamin. His family is now complete. But at the same time, he experiences a tremendous personal loss. If I pause for one moment, let's just think. Since coming back to the land of Israel, I said to you about breach in Jacob's family. His daughter was raped. His mother died. Now his beloved wife is dying. And then we have one more story, which is a further breach. After his mother dies, Jacob comes to a place which is called Migdal Eder, chapter 35, verse 21. He pitches a tent, and then all of a sudden we're told how his son Reuven goes and sleeps with Bilhah, the concubine of his father, which means that now there is a defilement of the house of Jacob, not by someone from the outside, by Shechem, who rapes his daughter, but by his own son, his eldest son, who sleeps with his concubine, who in fact is not his concubine, she's his wife, Bilhah. The rabbis and many commentaries have great difficulty with taking this verse literally, that Reuven slept with her. And there's a rabbinic comment which Rashi quotes, that Reuven did not really sleep with her. What Reuven did was to dishevel her bed. What Reuven did was to basically try to give a message to Jacob. Why are you sleeping with this concubine? Because she is the maid of Rachel. Because somehow by sleeping with her, it's as if you're still maintaining some connection to Rachel. Why don't you sleep with Leah, who is truly your wife? Which means that in the same way that on one level, Shimon and Levi were defending the honor of the family, were reacting to the violation of their sister, the defilement of their sister, were standing up for the honor of the family. On another level, Reuven is doing the same thing, standing up for the honor of his mother. His mother, who has always felt rejected by Yaakov, and even after Rachel dies, is still not beloved to Yaakov. So Reuven does a very bold, one might say insulting, one might say defiling act. In fact, later on, I mentioned the blessings which Jacob gives his sons. Jacob also refers to Reuven as somebody who desecrated his bed. So once more, we have a further crack in the house of Jacob. And yet, in the aftermath of this, we are told in chapter 23, Vayuvnei Yaakov 12, the sons of Jacob were 12. So what would I like to point out? It seems to be that when Jacob comes back in our parsha, there is the possibility of creating a closure of all the events that led to his running away. There is the possibility of starting a new page. There is some closure, and there is a new chapter which is being written. But within all that, there are many, many breaches. There is no reconciliation between Yaakov and Esav. There is no reconnecting between Yaakov and his mother. There is barely a reconnecting between Yaakov and his father. We are told in the verses which come immediately after, the end of chapter 35, how Yaakov goes to his father, but we don't find any kissing, we don't find any hugging, we don't find any speech, nothing that would indicate any type of real relationship between them. And within the family of Jacob, which is complete, which reaches completion, with the birth of the 12th son, Binyamin, in the land of Israel, there are breaches. The rape of Dinah, the destruction of Shechem, the incident of Bilhah, all of these create breaches. Breaches which are, in one form or another, mended. So that in the end we can say that Jacob's family, his sons are 12. On a certain level they are whole, but perhaps we should say scarred. I would just like to end by saying that Jacob's greatness is that he does found a house. He does create a family. He creates a family which ultimately are all included as part of the Jewish people, as part of the Jewish destiny. His challenge is to deal with the internal struggles and external struggles which confront that house, with all the pain that results from that. And that is why, despite the fact that Jacob's name is changed to Israel, he still is Yaakov. Israel is a sign of triumph. Yaakov is the one who comes from behind. Yaakov is the one who is always struggling to survive. And that is the dialectic that he lives with. His life is filled with struggles for survival. Ultimately, he emerges as Israel. But perhaps, as was mentioned in our parsha, in the aftermath of the struggle with this man who appears to him from nowhere, he is given a blessing by that man, who the rabbis understand to be an angel. You are Israel. But he emerges from that encounter limping. And perhaps this is the story of his life. He goes from struggle to struggle, from crisis to crisis. One might even say barely making it through each crisis, yet ultimately he emerges as Israel. And ultimately he succeeds at creating the children of Israel. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.